Okay, so we are now, we've completed all the way through almost the end of the second chapter of Shmuel, and we're now ready to begin the man of God, Ish Elokim, man of God, who comes to warn Eli about what's going to happen. Just to remind everyone, because a couple of weeks ago already, Eli's sons were terrible. And they were not really treating the temple the right way, the Mishkan, the tabernacle. They were the designated Kohanim who were supposed to arrange for all the sacrifices and make everything happen. But they weren't being very good. So now, a man of God, and of course that's contrasted with Shmuel. If you look on the left side at the bottom, verse 26. Young Samuel, meanwhile, grew in esteem and favor, both with God and with men. So Shmuel was doing just fine, all the way at the bottom of the left side of the page. So now we're up to the next paragraph, verse 27. Vayavo ish Elokim el Eli, a man of God came to Eli, vayomer elav, ko amar Hashem, haniglo nigleti el beit avicha, man of God came to Eli and said to him, thus said the Lord, I revealed myself to your father's house in Egypt when they were subject to the house of Paro. And I chose them from among all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to ascend my altar, to burn incense, and to carry an ephod before me. And I assign to your father's house all offerings by fire of the Israelites. So what are they talking about? What is the man of God referring to? He's referring to the selection of the tribe of Levi, namely Aharon, Moshe's brother, to be the Kohanim, to be the priests of the Mishkan and then later the temple. So the man of God is sort of reviewing history with Eli, the history of Eli's family, because Eli is the Kohen, and he's reviewing the history of their family. So he says, look, all the way back in Egypt, so long ago, I chose your ancestors to run this place. Why then do you maliciously trample upon the sacrifices and offerings that I have commanded? Right, I chose you. And by the way, note an important thing to note is look at how many times the man of God, speaking in God's name, says, look at the key word in verse 28. I chose them from among all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to ascend my altar, to burn incense and to carry an ephod before me. It's all about servicing God, right? It was supposed to be about God. Eli's sons made it about themselves, stealing the meat. If you remember, they would take the forks and steal the meat from the people
when
who were coming to give sacrifices.
He's a man of God.
He's a prophet.
An angel or is that
no, he's a prophet. He's a prophet. He's a prophet.
Oh, it's just a person.
Yeah, it's a person.
Oh.
He's representing God.
But we don't know any more about him.
Maybe he's an angel. I don't know. We don't know anything about him besides the fact that it says he's a man of God.
He's a prophet.
I would guess he's a prophet. Versus man of God.
Well, Ish Elokim.
God sent them to represent himself. So it's either a man, it's either a prophet, or maybe it's an angel, but I would guess it's a prophet. Because he's speaking directly to a human being. Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about what makes somebody a prophet soon.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. Why then do you maliciously trample upon the sacrifices and offerings that I've commanded? You have honored your sons more than me, feeding on the first portions of every offering of my people Israel. Assuredly, declares the Lord, the God of Israel, declares the Lord, the God of Israel, I intended for you and your father's house to remain in my service forever. But now, declares the Lord, far be it from me, for I honor those who honor me. But those who spurn me shall be dishonored." And now the man of God will list punishments for Eli and his household. "A time is coming when I will break your power and that of your father's house, and there shall be no elder in your house. You will gaze grudgingly at all the bounty that will be bestowed on Israel, but there shall never be an elder in your house. I shall not cut off all your offspring from my altar, but to make your eyes pine and your spirit languish, all the increase in your house shall die as ordinary men. And this shall be a sign for you. The fate of your two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, they shall both die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will act in accordance with my wishes and my purposes. I will build for him an enduring house, and he shall walk before my anointed evermore. And all the survivors of your house shall come and bow low to him for the sake of a money fee and a loaf of bread, and shall say, 'Please assign me to one of the priestly duties that I may have a morsel of bread to eat.'" Oh. Wow.
That's enough to scare you.
So what are the punishments that are going to happen to the house of Eli?
The children and the no elder.
Okay, so they're going to die early. Yeah. They're going to die young. That's one punishment. What's another punishment?
They won't have food.
Why won't they have food? What do you mean?
Unless they do something.
What do you mean they won't have food?
You can't take the things.
They have to bow to him for the sake of money and a loaf of bread.
Good. Meaning what? Where do they get their food from up until now? How do Kohanim get their food?
They take a portion from the offering.
They take a portion.
Yeah.
So if they can't do that anymore, what does that mean?
They have to go out and work for it.
Means they're not the Kohanim anymore. The priesthood is taken away from the house of Eli. They have to go out and work like everybody else. I mean, they work too. The Kohanim, if everything works properly, not most people are farmers and, get their own food. The Kohanim work in the temple. It's not that they're not working. They work all day also, but they, since they're not farming and they don't make their own food, they have to get their food from elsewhere, their subsistence from elsewhere. Okay, so that's punishment number two. I think there's a third punishment also. What's the third punishment?
The fate of the sons.
To die. So we mentioned that already. They're going to die young. That's one punishment. Another punishment is that they will no longer be Kohanim. So what's the third punishment?
Well, everyone else will appear to be flourishing, but they will not.
So it's an ironic. Even though they're going to die young, his line won't completely die out. It sounds a little bit vengeful. His lineage won't die out completely, specifically so that they will observe everybody else having a good life. Your sons will die and they're going to die young, but there will always be a remnant of your family. So they will tell the history of what happened. They will tell, "Oh, our ancestors were the Kohanim and look at us now. Look at the great Kohanim and look at us now." Sounds like, right?
Yeah.
I shall not.
That they're stripped of their duties?
No. The third punishment is that even though they'll die young, they'll never completely die out, so that there will always be a remnant to observe how great everybody else is doing, and they're doing so terribly. But you will gaze grudgingly at all the bounty that will be bestowed on Israel, but there shall never be an elder in your house. I shall not cut off all your offspring for my altar, to make your eyes pine and your spirit languish. This reminds me, you ever see the movie The Princess Bride?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Inigo Montoya suggests...
"You killed my father."
You killed my father, that's right. So he has a punishment for the other guy. where it's, no, sorry, the main character, I forgot his name. The main character has a punishment where he almost kills somebody, but not completely. He leaves the eyes or the ears. One part of the body is left intact so they can observe everyone else, you know, scorning them and, you know, and all of that.
It's like Tantalus, you know, they could be the eye of
right.
The grapes.
The Princess Bride.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a Rob Reiner movie. Okay. What?
My kids love that movie.
That's a great movie.
Great movie.
Sure. Okay. So what do you make of these three punishments? The death, premature death, that's one. Two was the priesthood is taken away from them. And three is that they will have to observe everyone else's successes and always remember their failures.
That's a tough one.
That's hard.
So, one essay that I read about this suggested that two of them are clearly an eye for an eye as to what the sons of Eli did. Number one, the priesthood is taken away from them because they didn't respect the priesthood. They didn't do their job. They abused their powers.
Yeah.
And number two, they will have to observe the successes of others because they forced others to observe their own, you know, excesses, exactly. Right? They subjected others to watching them eat the meat and all of that. What do you make of dying young? Why? What kind of punishment is that?
It's a hard one. As you get older, you worry about that because you want to see, like I would like to see my grandchildren married with children and know that I'm probably not going to be around for that. You know, that's tough.
They're talking about really young
trouble. Really young.
Like teenagers or something.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They're going to die young.
Because everybody else lives old. They're all old people.
You know,
they, how young is young,
that you said they'll die?
We'll see. We're going to see the deaths of Hophni and Pinchas in future chapters.
Or 20s?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
It doesn't say their ages exactly.
This is different from Pinchas who...
Yeah, that's an old. I mean, Pinchas in the Torah. That's hundreds of years ago. From here.
Oh yeah, of course.
So if you look at the language that's used, they never say you're going to die young. What's the exact word used?
There shall never be an elder in your house.
There shall never be an elder in your house. There shall never be an
elder. So, like, they're not saying your father won't be in your house. They're just saying somebody old won't be in your house.
They'll never.
So what, if you recall 2 weeks ago, if you go back a page to the previous page, verse 22 in chapter 2. The first thing we saw is now Eli was very old. Eli was very old. And he wasn't able to control his sons or to influence them to act properly. The role of an elder is to be wise and to be a role model for the younger people. And Eli was not successful. He was not a successful elder. His sons were abusing their priesthood.
Sometimes you could be perfect and you have kids who aren't good.
That's true.
Yeah, that's right.
That's true.
There'd be elders who are trying to be
don't
there.
Always have control over it.
We know that, right, as grandparents?
Well, it's considered, you know, the parent is supposed to bring up the child properly. But, you know, of course you have the whole wayward son thing in the Torah, so...
Right.
So you're responsible for your kids'
It's a real interesting issue now. I mean, just having come from my kids and hearing from my daughter, Hema don't say anything about how this or that is exactly. I mean, I usually try not to. Husband is less
diplomatic.
Doesn't keep his lip zipped like they tell you for granted. So you know, you feel like you've been there, you've seen it, you know what's going to happen, and you're not allowed to say anything. So we have the best intentions,
right?
But we're not allowed to say anything. So in a sense, it's not even Ellie's fault. It may not have been his fault at all. It just maybe it's the culture that's changing. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Or he was just unlucky with his.
Well, but if he saw it happening and he didn't reprimand them, maybe he tried to, I don't know. Maybe he said, hey, don't do that, and they said, get lost. I don't know.
Well, if you remember from a couple of weeks ago, Ali only didn't even see his sons doing this. He just heard.
He wasn't aware.
He heard hearsay. He comes and says, I heard you're abusing your priestly privileges.
Yeah, that makes it sound like he was.
He was kind of not really doing his job.
Yeah.
So I think that's where that punishment comes from also. There, meaning it's not about dying young. It's about his family not having good elders. Saying there will be no more elders in your household because you failed as an elder. You didn't do your job as an elder. Okay.
The wisdom of an elder.
Right. Okay, we're gonna move on now.
So these
three punishments, we're going to see them play out. I mean, we're going to have a several chapter break from this, but we'll see Hophni and Pinchas die. And we're going to see the priesthood now transferring, moving hands. Chapter 3. V'hana'ar Shmuel mesharet et Hashem lifnei Eli. Udvar Hashem haya yakar beyamim ahem, ein chazon nifratz. Young Samuel served the Lord under Eli. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. Prophecy was not widespread. What do you think that means?
In Hebrew, yakar is precious.
Precious.
So
it was rare.
It was precious probably because it was rare.
Yeah.
You didn't hear very much of it, so you had to grab whatever it
right.
was.
Right. Ein chazon nifratz. Prophecy was not very common. Mm-hmm. What do you think it means that prophecy is not common? So that's really what we have to do. In order to really understand the rest of Tanakh, you have to really understand prophecy. Because it's all going to be about prophecy.
Does it mean that the people weren't educated?
No.
Well, so let me just ask you. If I say a prophet, what do you think it means?
An educated leader, a servant of God, maybe, to help the people, lead the people.
I think the first thing that most people think is it's going to be someone who can foretell the future. That's not the only thing they do.
So the first thing is, right, the first thing is somebody who can foretell the future. Who makes somebody a prophet? How did Moshe become a prophet? Moshe was the greatest of all prophets. How did that, play out?
He was chosen by Hashem.
Why was he chosen?
He couldn't say
you
no.
You've got to believe that Hashem is the only one who can make somebody a prophet.
Only God can make someone a prophet. What do you think, Faye?
And why him? Because he sees that man has vision of spirituality, vision of goodness, goodness of knowledge, wisdom, and getting it across in the right way. And to me,
okay. So Maimonides, in his Guide of the Perplexed, explains very clearly what prophecy is and what prophecy is not. There are those who disagree with Maimonides, but I agree with him, so we're going to read.
I love Maimonides.
Okay. We're in chapter 32 of the second volume of the Guide of the Perplexed. This is all in English, so.
Good.
You know, when I was teaching my conversion class here for like 15 years here, a guy came to me to sign up, and he said, "Why are you coming?" And he said, he gave me the Guide to the Perplexed he had found in the library, and he said, "I want to understand. I want to come here and understand this because I am so perplexed."
Interesting. Oh, maybe another, you know, another round of Torah and Tea, we could study the Guide to the Perplexed instead of Tanakh. I love the Guide to the Perplexed. Amazing. Obviously, an amazing work.
I had a Purim costume, and I was Maimonides, and I carried this big thing that said Guide to the Perplexed, and you open it up, and there was a mirror.
So I apologize for the notes on the side. I photocopied this for my personal copy of the Guide to the Perplexed.
More exciting, yeah.
Okay. The opinions of people concerning prophecy are like their opinions concerning the eternity of the world or its creation and time. I mean by this that just as the people whose mind the existence of the deity is firmly established, to whose mind the, have, as we have set forth, three opinions concerning the eternity of the world or its creation and time, so are there also three opinions concerning prophecy. So this is just because earlier Maimonides had discussed how the world was created, and he said there are basically three opinions among people in the world about it. So too there are three opinions about prophecy. I shall not pay attention to the opinion of Epicurus. Who was Epicurus?
He believed in feasting.
Apicorus, right? You heard of the term Apicorus? Somebody doesn't believe in God, a heretic. So that Apicorus in Hebrew comes from the Greek philosopher Epicurus. For he does not believe in the existence of a deity, and all the more does he not believe in prophecy. I only aim to set forth the opinions of those who believe in the deity. Okay. First opinion, that of the multitude of those among the pagans who consider prophecy as true. So this is the opinion of non-Jews. Pagans just means non-Jews in this case, who think that prophecy is true, and also believed by some of the common people professing our law. What does that mean? It's believed by Jews too. Many Jews believe this. Is that God, may he be exalted, chooses whom he wishes from among men, turns him into a prophet, and sends him with a mission. According to them, it makes no difference whether this individual is a man of knowledge or ignorant, aged or young. However, they also posit as a condition his having a certain goodness and sound morality. For up to now, people have not gone so far as to say that God sometimes turns a wicked man into a prophet, unless he has first, according to this opinion, turned him into a good man. That's the first opinion. He says this is not the correct opinion. Right, many people believe that God chooses the prophets. Maimonides says that's not true. God does not choose the prophets. That is in line with our verse that we read. Prophecy was not common. Right? Prophecy was a rare thing. The second opinion is that of the philosophers. It affirms that prophecy is a certain perfection in the nature of man. That's the first part, right? Prophecy is something within a person. It's a perfection within the nature of man. This perfection is not achieved in any individual from among men, except after a training that makes that which exists in the potentiality of the species pass into actuality, provided an obstacle due to temperament or to some external cause does not hinder this, as is the case with regard to every perfection whose existence is possible in a certain species. So within human potential, there is a certain human potential. A prophet is someone who has actualized all of that human potential. This is the view of the philosophers. For the existence of that perfection in its extreme and ultimate form in every individual of that species is not possible. Right? Not everybody can actualize. Right? Albert Einstein actualized a certain potential. We all have the potential to be very, you know, bright and study and all of that. But we, not all of us can actualize that potential. We have that potential because we're human beings and we have a brain and we have, you know, the genetic makeup necessary to think. All human beings can think. But Albert Einstein was able to actualize that potential of thought, of intellect. Most people can't. That's okay. Not everyone needs to do that, but some people can. The existence of that perfection in its extreme and ultimate form in every individual of the species is not possible. It must, however, exist necessarily in at least one particular individual. If, in order to be achieved, this perfection requires something that actualizes it, that something necessarily exists. Okay. According to this opinion, it is not possible that an ignoramus should turn into a prophet. Nor can a man not be a prophet on a certain evening and be a prophet on the following morning, as though he had made some find. Right? If one is a prophet, then he's a prophet. It's not that God gives you prophecy on Sunday and then on Monday he takes away the prophecy. You're either a prophet or you're not a prophet. Things are rather as follows. When, in the case of a superior individual who is perfect with respect to his rational and moral qualities, his imaginative faculty is in its most perfect state, when he has been prepared in the way that you will hear, he will necessarily become a prophet. What does that mean, he will necessarily become a prophet? Necessarily.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. It's a natural phenomenon, prophecy. Some people, if they study hard enough and they have the right, they have the right, you know, IQ or whatever, and they have the right moral perfection, and they have the right, you know, they study enough philosophy, they will inevitably become prophets. Okay?
Also, it says here, it's been prepared in the way that you will hear.
Yes, we're not going to, that's a lot of chapters. you will hear, it will take a long time, yeah.
Prophetic meditation.
That's not what he talks. He's talking about study. He talks about study. For him, the main, you know, it's physical and intellectual and moral perfection. That's what Maimonides means by preparation. That means studying, and not just the time. It means studying everything there is to study. It means exercise, everything. Maimonides believed that there were 12 levels of people. Moses was 12. All the rest of us, not 12. You know, other prophets are 10 or 11. If you want to be a prophet, you got to be like 10 or 11. And the rest of us are probably somewhere between, you know, 1 to 5 or something like that.
Is it possible to have one in our day and age?
So, according to the philosophers, it is. According to Maimonides, it's not. We're not up to Maimonides' opinion yet. We're up to the philosopher's opinion, the second opinion.
The time of Nebuah has passed.
Inasmuch as this perfection that belongs to us by nature. According to this opinion, it is not possible that an individual should be fit for prophecy and prepared for it and not become a prophet, except to the extent to which it is possible that an individual having a healthy temperament should be nourished with excellent food without sound blood and similar things that being generated from that food. Meaning if you eat right, then you exercise right, then your body will operate properly. That's what Maimonides believed. So just as if you eat right and exercise right, your body will operate properly, so too if somebody is at this level where they can attain prophecy, they will attain prophecy. It's just a natural occurrence. The way I have heard this described by Professor Menachem Kellner, as a professor of Jewish philosophy in Haifa, uses this allegory, and he says that it's like, imagine that God emits radio waves of truth, okay? And he's constantly emitting them into the world, right? God is this energy. God is an abstract being. He's not a person with a beard or anything. It's an abstract thing. Constantly emitting this energy of truth, of that which is true. That which is right and morally true and factually true and philosophically true and all those things. True in every possible way. We as human beings, our main purpose in life is to try to find the right radio frequency to attain that truth. And that's what we're doing by studying and by exercising and by eating right and by philosophizing and by thinking and by all those things. We are constantly trying to find, if the frequency is 10-10, you know, we're hovering around, we're 10-11. It's a little bit fuzzy, you know, we have moments of truth. But a prophet is someone who has found the radio frequency and he's turned himself into that frequency. So it's impossible for him not to attain prophecy. He's attaining it. Because
he's tuned in.
He's tuned in. Yeah. And what that means, for the philosophers, prophecy is a completely natural phenomenon. So what a prophet thinks, because a prophet is so perfect and so bright and so smart and so, you know, perfect in every way, what the prophet thinks is what God thinks, because he's perfect, so he knows. Okay. The third opinion is the opinion of our law and the foundation of our doctrine. It is identical with the philosophic opinion. Okay? That's the most important part. That opinion of natural prophecy, that is Maimonides' opinion, except for one thing. For we believe that it may happen to one who is fit for prophecy and prepared for it, should not become a prophet, namely on account of the divine will. God can block prophecy. Okay? So even though God is emitting these waves of truth, and God is this abstract being that represents all that is true in the world, and we can work very hard and try to attain that prophecy and try to guide ourselves to attain God's will, God can still block us from attaining it.
It's his choice.
To my mind, it's the inverse of the first opinion. The first opinion says that God just decides who is a prophet, and he picks the prophet. This is the inverse. Prophecy is naturally occurring. Anybody can become a prophet. But God can just decide that you're not fit, that you shouldn't be a prophet. Okay? So it's imagine this radio frequency thing again. But on occasion, God can block the radio from transmitting waves to you. To my mind, this is like all the miracles and takes the same course as they. It's a miracle that God can block prophecy. But it sounds counterintuitive. You might think prophecy is a miracle. The fact that somebody can attain God's will, that's a miracle. That's what the first opinion thought. The multitudes, the pagans, that's what they believe. But the opposite is true. Prophecy is natural. The miracle is that God can block prophecy.
He's the all-powerful.
He scrambles the broadcast.
That's right, he scrambles the broadcast. That's right.
Oh, God. So,
okay.
Is there a sense of why God might...
So take a look. Let's keep reading this. For it is a natural thing that everyone who, according to his natural disposition, is fit for prophecy and who has been trained in his education and study should become a prophet. That would be the natural thing. If you're really fit to be a prophet, then you'd be a prophet. He who is prevented from it is like him who has been prevented, like Yerovam, from moving his hand, or like the king of Aram's army going to seek Elisha, from seeing. As for its being fundamental with us that the prophet must possess preparation and perfection in the moral and rational qualities, it is indubitably the opinion expressed in their dictum. Prophecy only rests upon the wise, strong, and rich man. We've explained in our commentary on the Mishnah and in our great compilation. The great compilation is the Mishnah Torah. And we have set forth that the disciples of the prophets were always engaged in preparation. As for the fact that one who prepares is sometimes prevented from being a prophet, you may know it from the history of Baruch, the son of Neriah. For he followed Jeremiah, who trained, taught, and prepared him. And he set himself the goal of becoming a prophet, but was prevented, as he says, I am weary with my groaning and I find no rest. So he gives examples of people in Tanakh that were fit to be prophets, but they were not prophets. And of course, now in exile, God blocks all prophecy. Okay? When we're in the exile, there is no prophecy. Turn to the next page. And here's where he explains how it works. Know that the true reality and quiddity of prophecy... The back page, the last page, right there. Know that the true reality and quiddity of prophecy consists in it being an overflow, overflowing from God, may be cherished and honored, through the intermediation of the active intellect toward the rational faculty in the first place, and thereafter toward the imaginative faculty. This is very complicated Greek philosophical terminology. The active intellect is... active intellect is God. So God emanates truth. We human beings have a rational faculty and an imaginative faculty. Okay, rational faculty is the ability to process facts and truths and things like that.
You know, left brain.
Yeah, and imaginative faculty is the ability to act on those facts and to see those facts into the future, to know what those facts lead to and what they mean. So a prophet needs to have perfection in the rational faculty and perfection in the imaginative faculty in order to, and somebody like that will attain prophecy. So as you can see, assuming that that's what prophecy means, in the days of Eli and his sons, the world was corrupt. That's why prophecy... What does it mean that prophecy was rare? Prophecy was rare because there weren't people like that. The world wasn't really functioning very well. Of course, we will read next week that Shmuel was going to be the next prophet. So if you look, you know, just back to our text, prophecy was rare. Young Samuel was in the service of the Lord, and in those days, prophecy was rare. It was not widespread. Chapter 3 will be the transformation of Shmuel into a prophet, and we will see that, please God, next week.